least at all. He invited me to step down to continue our conversation and motioned to two chairs beneath a round, leaded glass window. We sat, and the blue and rose light streaming through the glass spilled over our shoulders. "Which volume did you take?" he asked. "Close your eyes." He did, and I hiked my shift up to retrieve the book. "This one," I said, holding it out to him. He opened his eyes.
"Venden?"
"I'm curious about the language. Do you know it?" He shook his head.
"Only a few words. I've never encountered a barbarian. But sometimes soldiers bring back verbal souvenirs. Words not meant to be repeated in sacristas."
He leaned forward to take the book from me and leafed through it.
"Hmm. I missed this one. It looks like it only provides a few common phrases. Not exactly a Venden primer."
"Do any of the priests here know the language?" He shook his head.
I wasn't surprised. The barbarian language was as far away and foreign to Morrigan as the moon, and not held in nearly as high regard. Barbarians were rarely captured, and when they were, they didn't speak. Regan's squad had once accompanied a prisoner back to an outpost, and Regan said the man never spoke a single word the whole way. He was killed when he tried to escape, and finally uttered some gibberish as he lay dying. The words had stuck with Regan even though he didn't know what they meant.
Kevgor in te deos pavium.
After so long a silence, Regan said it was gripping to hear him say it over and over again until his final breath ran out. The words chilled him with their sorrow. The priest handed the book back to me.
Why would you need to know the language of a distant land?
I looked at the book in my lap and ran my fingers over the soiled leather cover.
I want what you stole.
Let's just call it a multitude of curiosities.
Do you know of trouble?
Me? I know nothing. As I'm sure you're well aware from your talks with Pauline, I'm a fugitive now. I have no connections to the crown anymore.
There are many kinds of knowing.
That again. I shook my head. I'm not.
Trust your gifts, Arabella. Whatever they might be. Sometimes a gift requires great sacrifice. But we can no more turn our backs on it than will our hearts not to beat.
I hardened my expression to stone. I wouldn't be pushed. He leaned back in his chair, loosely crossing one leg over the other. Not a pious priestly pose.
Did you know the guard is marching on the upper highway? He asked. 2,000 troops being moved to the southern border.
Today? I said. During the High Holy Days?
He nodded. Today.
I looked away and traced the scrolled line in the arm of the chair with my finger. This wasn't a simple rotation of troops. That many soldiers weren't deployed, especially during the holy days, unless concerns were real. I recalled what Walther had said. Marauders have been creating all manner of bedlam. But he'd also said, "We'll keep them out. We always do." Walther had been confident. Surely the moving of troops was only a preemptive strategy. More chest-beating, as Walther would call it. The numbers and timing were unusual, but with Father trying to save face with Dalbrek, he might be shaking his power in their faces like a fist. 2,000 troops was a formidable fist. I stood.
So the book is mine to take?
He smiled.
Yes.
That was it? Just yes? He was far too cooperative. Nothing came that easy. I raised a brow. And where do we stand? A small chuckle escaped from his lips.
He stood so we were eye to eye.
If you mean, will I report your presence? The answer is no.
Why? It could be construed as treason.
What Pauline told me was in holy confidence, and you've admitted nothing, only that you came to borrow a book.
And I haven't seen Princess Arabella since she was a wailing baby.
You've changed a bit since then, except for the wailing part, I'm told. No one would expect me to recognize you.
I smiled, still trying to figure him out.
Why?
I asked again. He grinned and raised one brow.
17 years ago, I held a squalling infant girl in my hands. I lifted her up to the gods, praying for her protection and promising mine. I'm not a fool. I keep my promises to the gods, not men.
I eyed him uncertainly, biting the corner of my lip.
A true man of the gods?
He slid his arm around my shoulder and walked me to the door, telling me if I wanted any other books, all I had to do was ask. When I was halfway across the vestibule, he whispered after me,
I wouldn't speak to the other priests of this matter. They might not all agree where loyalty should lie. Understood?
Clearly. The bell of the sacrista rang again, this time heralding the noon hour. My stomach rumbled. I stood at the side of the sanctuary, shaded in a dark nook of the northern portico as I looked through the book.
Kenche Torena Shiame?
What is your name?
Bedage Nit.
Come out.
Sevende.
Hurry.
Adwa Bas.
Sit down.
Mine Bogeve.
Do not move. It sounded like a soldier's rudimentary command book for managing prisoners, but I could study it more later. Maybe it would help me understand my own small book from Venda. I closed it, hiding it away in my clothing, and looked out over the heads of the festival goers. I spotted Pauline's honey hair shimmering beneath a crown of pink flowers. I was about to call out to her when I felt a whisper at my neck.
At last.
Warm shivers prickled my skin. Rafe's chest pressed close to my back, and his finger traveled along my shoulder and down my arm.
I thought we'd never get a moment alone.
His lips brushed my jaw. I closed my eyes, and a shudder sprinted through me. We're hardly alone, I said. Can't you see an entire town milling in front of you? His hand circled my waist, his thumb stroking my side.
I can't see anything but this.
He kissed my shoulder, his lips traveling over my skin until they reached my ear.
And this. And this.
I turned around, and my mouth met his. He smelled of soap and fresh cotton.
Someone might see us,
I said, breathless between kisses.
So?
I didn't want to care, but I gently nudged away, mindful that it was broad daylight and the shadow of a nook afforded very little privacy. A reluctant smile lifted a corner of his mouth.
Our timing always seems to be off. A moment alone, but with a whole town as an audience.
Tonight there'll be food and dancing and plenty of shadows to get lost in. We won't be missed. His expression became solemn as his hands tightened on my waist.
Leah,
He cut off his own words. I looked at him, confused. I'd thought he'd be glad about the possibility of slipping away.
What is it?
His smile returned, and he nodded.
Tonight.
We caught up with Pauline, and soon enough Caden found us too. There were no more bouts in the mud, but from fish catching to fire building to axe throwing, The competition was evident. Pauline rolled her eyes at each event as if to say, "Here we go again." I shrugged in return. I was used to my brother's competitive spirit and enjoyed a good contest myself, but Rafe and Caden seemed to take it to a new level. Finally, their stomachs overruled the games, and they both went off in search of the smoked venison that teased through the air. For now, Pauline and I were content with our pastries and continued to stroll the grounds. We came to the knife-throwing field, and I handed Pauline my sugared orange brioche, which she happily took. Her appetite had returned. "I want to give this game a try," I told her as I headed for the entry gate. There was no wait, and I lined up with three other contestants. I was the only female. Positioned 15 feet away were large round slices of painted logs, the non-moving kind of targets that I liked. 5 knives lay on tables next to each of us. I looked them over and lifted them, judging their weight. They were all heavier than my own knife and certainly not as balanced. The game master explained that we would all throw at the same time at his command until all 5 knives were thrown.
"Lift your weapons. Ready?"
"He's watching." The words hit me like cold water. I scanned the festival goers crowding the rope boundary. I was being watched. I didn't know by whom, but I knew. I was being watched, not by the hundreds who surrounded the event, but by one.
"Throw!"
I hesitated, and then threw. My knife hit the target handle first and bounced off, falling to the ground. All the other contestants' knives stuck in the wood circles, one in the outer bark, one in the outer white ring, one in the blue ring, none in the center red. We hardly had time to grab the next knife before the game master called again,
"Throw!"
Mine struck with a loud thunk, slicing into the white outer circle and staying put. Better, but these knives were clunky and not terribly sharp.
"He's watching." The words crawled up my neck.
"Throw!"
My knife flew past the target entirely, lodging in the dirt beyond. My frustration grew. I couldn't use distractions as an excuse. Walther had told me that so many times. That was the point of practice, to block out distractions. In the real world, when a knife was needed, distractions didn't politely wait for you to throw. They sought to disarm you.
Watching. Watching.
I held the tip tight, fixed my shoulder, and let my arm do the work.
Throw!
This time I hit the line between white and blue. I took a deep breath. There was only one knife left. I looked out at the crowds again.
Watching. I felt the derision, the mocking gaze, a smirk at my less than impressive knife-throwing skills. But I couldn't see a face. Not the face.
Watch then, I thought, my ire rising. I lifted my hem.
Throw!
My knife sliced through the air so fast and clean it was hardly seen. It hit red, dead center. Out of 20 throws by 4 contestants, mine was the only one to hit red. The game master took a second look, confused, and then disqualified me. It was worth it. I scanned the mass of onlookers lining the ropes and caught a glimpse of a retreating back being swallowed by the crowd. The nameless soldier? Or someone else? It was a lucky throw. I knew that, but my watcher didn't. I walked over to the target, pulled my gem-studded dagger from the center, and returned it to its sheath on my thigh. I would practice as I'd promised Walther. There would be no more throws left to luck.
The Crowned and Beaten, The tongue and sword, together they will attack like blinding stars thrown from the heavens. Song of Venda. Chapter 35. Caden.
I didn't trust him. He was more than just the farmhand he claimed to be. His moves on that log were far too practiced. But practiced in what? And that hellish beast he rode, that wasn't the average docile nag from a farm. He was also strangely deft at disposing of a body, as if he'd done it before, not the least bit hesitant as a rural bumpkin might be, unless his rural activities ran on the darker side. He could be a farmhand, but he was something else, too. I scrubbed my chest with soap. His attentions toward Leah were just as bad. I'd heard her screaming at him to go away last night. The sudden singing of Birdie and the others drowned out what else was said, but I'd heard enough to know she wanted him to leave her alone. I should have followed, but Pauline was so intent on me staying. It was the first time I had seen her without her mourning scarf in weeks. She looked so fragile. I couldn't leave, nor would she let me. I rinsed my hair in the creek. It was my second bath of the day, but after catching fish, swinging axes, and racing to start a fire with two sticks, the so-called games had left me in need of more bathing, especially if I intended to dance with Leah tonight. And I did intend to dance with her. I'd make sure of that. The way she had looked at me last night, touched my shoulder, I wished things could have been different for us. Maybe at least for one night, they could be.
Chapter 36.
I leaned against the porch post. We were waiting for Birdie to join us for the walk to the plaza and the night's festivities. She had gone to wash up and change. It had been a long day, and I was still pondering the knife-throwing event and the strange feeling of being watched when certainly 100 people were watching me. What was one more? Pauline? I asked hesitantly. Do you ever know things? Just know them? She was silent for a long while, as if she hadn't heard me, but then finally looked up. You saw, didn't you? That day we passed the graveyard. You saw that Mikhail was dead. I pushed away from the post. What? No, I've thought about it many times since then. That look on your face that day. Your offer to stop. You saw him dead. I shook my head vigorously. No, it's not like that. I sat down beside her. I'm not a Ciara. I don't see like my mother did. I just sensed something. Something vague, but strong, too. A feeling. That day I just sensed something was wrong. She weighed this and shrugged. Then maybe it's not the gift. Sometimes I have a strong sense about things. In fact, I had a feeling something was wrong with Mikhail, too. A sense that he wasn't coming. It turned over and over inside me, but I refused to believe it. Maybe that was why I was even more eager for him to walk through the tavern door. I needed to be proved wrong. Then you don't think it's the gift. Your mother's gift came in visions. She looked down apologetically. At least it used to. My mother stopped seeing visions after I was born. On occasion, the vicious would imply I had stolen the gift from her while in her womb, which of course turned out to be laughable. Aunt Burnett said it wasn't me at all, that her gift slowly diminished after she arrived at the Citadel from her native land. Others claimed she'd never had it at all, but years ago, when I was very young, I had witnessed things. I had watched her gray eyes lose their focus, her concentration spike. Once, she had ushered us all out of harm's way before a spooked horse trampled the path where we had just been standing. Another time, she led us outside before the ground shook and stones crashed down, and often she shooed us away before my father would burst through in one of his foul moods. She always brushed it off, claiming she had heard the horse or felt the ground move before we did, but back then, I was certain it was the gift. I had seen her face. She saw what would happen before it did, or saw it happen from afar, like the day she took to her room in grief on the day her father died, though she didn't receive the news until 2 weeks later, when a messenger finally arrived. But in these latter years, there had been nothing. "Even if it's not a vision," Pauline said, "it could still be a gift. There could be other kinds of knowing." A chill clutched my spine. "What did you say?" She repeated her words, almost the same ones the priest had used that morning. She must have seen the distress on my face, because she laughed. "Leah, don't worry. I'm the one with the gift of seeing, not you. In fact, I'm having a vision now." She bounced to her feet and held her hands to her head in mock concentration. "I see a woman. A beautiful old woman in a new dress. Her hands are on her hips. Her lips are pursed. She's impatient. She's..." I rolled my eyes. "She's standing behind me, isn't she?" "Yes, I am," Birdie said. I spun and saw her standing in the tavern doorway just as described. Pauline squealed with delight. "Old," Birdie said. "Venerable," Pauline corrected and kissed her cheek. "You two ready?" Oh, I was ready. I had been waiting for this night all week. Crickets chirped, welcoming the shadows. The sky over the bay was draped with thin streamers of pink and violet, while the rest deepened to cobalt. A bronzed sickle moon held a pinprick star. Taravin painted a magical landscape. The air was still and warm, holding the whole town suspended. Safe. When we reached the main road, a crisscross of paper lanterns twinkled overhead. And then, as if the landscape alone weren't enough, the song. The prayer was sung as I'd never heard it sung before. A remembrance here, another there. Voices separate, combining, gathering, giving. A melody coming together. It was sung at different paces, different words rising, falling, streaming like a choir washed together in a cresting wave. Aching and true. "Leah, you're crying," Pauline whispered. Was I? I reached up and felt my cheeks, wet with tears. This was not crying. This was something else. As we got closer to town, Birdie's voice, with the most beautiful timbre of all, moved from song to greetings, the remembrances melting into the now. The smithy, the cooper, the fisherman, this craftsperson, that dressmaker, the clerks of the mercantile, the soapmaker who reminded Birdie she had some new scents she must try, they all offered their greetings. Soon, Birdie was pulled away. Pauline and I watched the musicians setting up, placing three chairs in a half circle. They set their instruments, a zitare, viola, and goblet drum, on the chairs and went to find some food and drink before their music began. While Pauline wandered off to sample the pickled eggs, I walked closer to examine the zitare. It was made of deep red cherry wood inlaid with thin seams of white oak and had worn marks where hands had rested through hundreds of songs.
I reached down and plucked one string. A dull pang rang through me. On rare occasions, my mother and her sisters would play their zitares, the three of them creating haunting music. My mother's voice wrenching and wordless, like an angel watching creation. When they played, a chill ran through the citadel and everything stopped. Even my father. He'd watch and listen from a distance, hidden away on the upper gallery. It was the music of her homeland, and it always made me wonder what sacrifices she had made to come to Morrigan to be its queen. Her sisters had followed 2 years later to be with her, but who else had she left behind? Maybe as he listened and watched, that was what my father was wondering, too. More people arrived for the evening festivities, and the chatter and laughter grew to a soothing buzz. The celebration had begun, and the musicians took their seats, filling the air with welcoming tunes. But something was still missing. I tracked down Pauline. "Have you seen him?" I asked. "Don't worry, he'll be here." She tried to pull me away to watch the lighting of the floating candles in the plaza fountain, but I told her I'd catch up with her later. I stood in the shadows outside the apothecary and watched the hands of the zitare player press and pluck, a mesmerizing dance in itself. I wished my mother had taught me how to use the instrument. I was about to walk closer when I felt a hand on my waist. He was here. Heat rushed through me, but when I turned, it wasn't Rafe. I sucked in a surprised breath. "Caden!" "I didn't mean to startle you." His eyes traveled over me. "You look radiant tonight." I glanced down, embarrassed, guilt pinching me for being too generous with my attentions last night. "Thank you." He motioned toward the street where people were dancing. "The music's playing," he said. "Yes, it just started." His damp blonde locks were combed back, and the scent of soap was still fresh on his skin. He nodded again toward the music, awkwardly boyish, though there was nothing else boyish about him. "Can we dance?" he asked. I hesitated, wishing they were playing a faster jig. I didn't want to lead him on, but I couldn't refuse a simple dance either. "Yes, of course," I answered. He took my hand and guided me to the space set aside in front of the musicians for dancing. One of his arms slid behind my back, and the other held my hand out to the side. I made sure our conversation was full, recounting the day's games so we could maintain some distance. But when talk lulled only briefly, he tugged me closer. His touch was gentle but firm, his skin warm against mine. "You've been kind to me, Leah," he said. He paused for a long while, his lips slightly parted. He cleared his throat. "I've enjoyed my time here with you." His tone had turned strangely solemn, and I saw the same gravity in his eyes. I looked at him, confused at the sudden change in his demeanor. "I've done little enough for you, Caden, but you saved my life." He shook his head. "You managed to break free. I'm sure you'd have been just as capable with your knife." "Maybe," I said. "But maybe not." "We'll never know what might have been." His fingers tightened on mine. "But we can't dwell on the maybes."
"No, I suppose we can't."
"We have to move on." Every word from him was weighted, as if he was thinking one thing but saying another. The unrest that had always lurked in his eyes doubled.
"You sound like you're leaving," I said.
"Soon. I have to return to my duties at home."
You never told me where home is. Lines deepened around his eyes.
Leah,
he said hoarsely. The music crawled. My heart thumped faster, and his hand slid lower on my back. Tenderness replaced the unrest, and his face dipped close to mine.
I wish...
A hand came down on his shoulder, surprising us both. Rafe's hand.
Don't be piggish, man,
Rafe said cheerfully, with a mischievous gleam in his eyes.
Give the other fellows a chance.
Astonishment paraded across Caden's face as if Rafe had dropped from the sky. In an instant, his surprise was replaced with a scowl. He looked from Rafe to me, and I shrugged to show it was only polite to dance with everyone. He nodded and stepped aside. Rafe slid his arm around me and explained he was late because the clothes he had laid out at the bathhouse had somehow gotten up and walked off by themselves. He'd finally had to make a mad dash to the barn loft with only a towel to cover himself. He eventually found his clothes tossed in Otto's stall. I suppressed a giggle, imagining him running to the loft draped only in a towel. Caden? Who else? Rafe pulled me closer, and his fingers gently strummed my spine. Hot splinters whirled in my stomach. We had only seconds together before the music changed to a fast jig. Soon we were pulled apart by the swift exchange of partners. The pace was brisk, and I found myself laughing, the lights twinkling and swirling past my view. More joining in. Pauline, Bertie, Gwyneth, priests, the farrier, little Simone holding her father's hand, strangers I didn't know. Everyone singing, hooting, stepping into the center circle to show off a few fancy steps. The zitare, viola, and drum thrumming at our temples. My face damp with the revelry, I finally had to catch my breath and step back to watch. It was a fast whirl of color and movement. Rafe dancing with Bertie, the seamstress, schoolgirls, Caden taking Pauline's hand, Gwyneth with the tanner, the miller, an endless circle of celebration and thanks. Yes, that's what it was. Thankfulness for this one moment, regardless of what the morrow might bring. The words Rafe had spoken rang clear again. Some things last. The things that matter. The very words I had scoffed at only weeks ago now filled me with wonder. Tonight was one of those things that would last. What I was witnessing right now, at this very moment. And I saw a time past, a time even before that. The ancients dancing in this very street, breathless, feeling the same joy I was experiencing now. The temples, the wondrous bridges, the greatness may not last, but some things do. Nights like this. They go on and on, outlasting the moon, because they're made of something else, something as quiet as a heartbeat and as sweeping as the wind. For me, tonight would last forever. Rafe spotted me on the fringe of the crowd and slipped away too. We walked through the plaza that was flickering with floating candles, the music fading behind us, and we disappeared into the dark shadows of the forest beyond, where no one, not Caden, Pauline, or anyone else, could find us.
Chapter 37.
I stretched in the bed, my legs sliding along the cool sheets, and smiled again. I had half slept, half dreamed, and half relived every moment all night long, too many halves to fit into one night. There was a bond between us I couldn't name, a sadness, a regret, a falling short, a past. I saw the yearning in his eyes,
Not just for me, but for something more. A peace, a wholeness. And I wanted to give it to him. I was immersed again in his tenderness, his finger tracing a line down my shoulder, slipping my strap free so he could kiss my back, his lips barely brushing along my kavah, my whole body tingling at his touch, our lips meeting over and over again. From the first day, Leah, I wanted this. Wanted you. Our fingers laced together, tumbling in a bed of leaves, my head resting on his chest, feeling the beat of his heart, his hand stroking my hair. I had to get some sleep, but I couldn't stop reliving it. I hadn't thought it could be this way, ever, with anyone. We had talked for hours. He loved fishing from a riverbank, but he rarely had the time. He hesitated when I asked about his parents, but then told me they had died when he was young. He had no one else, which explained why he had no schooling in the holy text. He had worked on a farm, mostly tending the horses and other livestock, but also helping with the fields. Yes, melons were one of the things they grew, just as I had imagined. He hated pigeon meat and was glad we left the dinner early yesterday. I shared my stories, too, mostly about forays into the mountains or forests with my brothers, who remained unnamed. I was careful to leave royal details out. He was surprised to learn I had favored swordplay over stitchery, backroom card games over music lessons. He promised to challenge me to a game one day. It was late when he walked me back. Pauline had left the lantern out for me. Our words just kept stringing on and on, always one more thing to say to keep us from parting, one more thing we needed to share. Finally, I kissed him one last time and told him good night, but as I reached for the door handle, he stopped me.
Leah, there's one more thing. Something else I need to...
Tomorrow, Rafe. We have all day tomorrow. It's late. He nodded, then lifted my hand to his lips and left. A perfect night. A perfect forever. I was in that half-awake dream world all night long, until the early morning hours, when the first muted light tiptoed along the ledge of the window, and my dreams finally gave way to sleep.
Chapter 38.
Leah. A nudge on my shoulder. Leah, wake up. Another nudge. Leah, you have to wake up. I startled awake, sitting upright. Pauline sat on the edge of the bed. The room was bright. I had slept all morning. What is it? I said, shielding my eyes against the light. And then I noticed Pauline's expression. What? It's Walther. He's behind the ice house. Something's wrong, Leah. He's... I was out of the bed, groggy, rummaging for pants, a shirt, something to throw on. Walther behind the ice house? My palms were damp with sweat. Pauline's voice was shrill. Something's wrong. I threw down whatever was bunched in my hands and ran out of the cottage barefoot and in my nightdress. I saw his Tobiano first, lathered and snorting, as if it had been ridden all night. "Take him to the barn and wipe him down," I called to Pauline, who was running behind me. I rounded the corner of the ice house and saw Walther sitting on the ground, leaning against a broken, overturned wheelbarrow that was stored there along with unused crates and a jumble of other cast-offs. "Leah," he said when he saw me. My breath stopped dead against my ribs. He had a gash on his forehead, but worse, his expression was crazed. This was a wild man pretending to be my brother. Walther, what is it? I rushed to his side and fell to my knees. My hand went to his forehead, and he looked at me and said, Leah, again, as if it were the first time. Walther, you're hurt. What happened? His eyes were desolate.
I have to do something, Leah. I have to do something.
I took his face in my hands, forcing him to look at me. Walther, please, I said firmly. You have to tell me what's wrong so I can help you. He looked at me, almost like a child.
You're strong, Leah. You were always the strongest of us. That's what worried Mother.
He was making no sense at all. His gaze drifted away and his eyes were glassy and rimmed in red.
There was nothing I could do, he said. Not for either of them.
I grabbed his shirt and shook him. Walther, what happened? He looked back at me, his lips cracked, his hair falling in his face in filthy, oily strands. His voice was passionless.
She's dead. Greta's dead.
I shook my head. It wasn't possible.
An arrow straight through her throat.
His gaze remained vacant.
She looked at me, Leah. She knew. Her eyes. She couldn't speak. She just looked at me, knowing. And then she fell forward into my lap. Dead.
I listened as my brother recounted each shattered piece of his dream. I held him, rocked him, huddled with him in the squalor and mud. When I saw Pauline and Birdie round the corner of the ice house, I waved them away. My brother, my strapping soldier brother, wept in my arms. He straddled a line between tears and dispassionate belief and told me every detail, unable to separate the relevant from the inconsequential. Her dress was blue. She had braided her hair in a circle around her head that morning. The baby was moving. They were on their way to Greta's aunt's house. It was only an hour's ride in a carriage from her parents' manor. Her sister and her family were in the carriage just behind them. They were going to have lunch. Only an hour, he repeated over and over again. An hour. And daylight. It was daylight. They were just about to cross the bridge from Chetsworth into Briar Glen when there was a tremendous roar. He heard the driver shout, there was a loud thump, and then the carriage lurched. He was about to look out to see what had happened when he heard another sound, the thump, thump, thump of arrows. He turned to shove Greta down, but it was too late.
They were there to destroy the bridge, he said.
His eyes were wide, his voice numb again, as if he had replayed the scene over in his own head 1,000 times already.
We came along just as it was going down. The driver shouted at them, and they killed him. Then sprayed us with more arrows before they galloped off.
Who, Walther? Who did this?
I took her back to her parents. I knew that's where she'd want to go. I took her back, Leah. I washed her. I wrapped her in a blanket and held her. Her and the baby. I held her for 2 days before they made me give her to them.
Who did this? He looked at me, his eyes suddenly focused again, his mouth contorting in disgust as if I hadn't been listening.
I have to go.
No, I whispered softly, trying to soothe him. No. I reached up to push his hair aside and check the gash in his forehead. He hadn't told me how he got it. In his crazed state, he probably didn't even know it was there. He pushed my hand away.
I have to go.
He tried to get up, and I pushed him back against the carcass of the wheelbarrow. Go where? You can't go anywhere like... He pushed me away roughly, and I fell back.
I have to go, he yelled. My platoon, I have to catch up.
I ran after him, pleading for him to stop. I pulled on him, begging him to wait, to at least let me wash his wounds, feed him something, clean his blood-soaked clothing. But he didn't seem to hear me. He grabbed the reins of his Tobiano and led him out of the barn. I yelled. I held on. I tried to pull the reins from him. He spun, grabbed both of my arms, shook me, screamed.
I'm a soldier, Leah. I'm not a husband anymore. I'm not a father. I'm a soldier.
Rage had made him into someone I didn't know. But then he pulled me to his chest and held me, sobbing into my hair. I thought my ribs would crack under his grip. Then he pushed away and said, "I have to go." And he did. And I knew there was nothing I could do to stop him.
Chapter 39.
It can take years to mold a dream. It takes only a fraction of a second for it to be shattered. I sat at the kitchen table, holding a piece of Walther's shattered dream. Gwyneth, Bertie, and Pauline sat with me. I had already told them everything I knew. They tried to reassure me that Walther would be all right, that he needed time to grieve, that he needed a lot of things I couldn't even hear them saying anymore. Instead, my head throbbed with my brother's cries. An arrow straight through her throat. Their voices were soft, tentative, quiet, trying to help me through this. But how could Walther ever be all right? Greta was dead. She fell open-eyed into his lap. Walther didn't leave here as a soldier. He left as a crazed man. He didn't leave to go join his platoon. He left to get his revenge. Gwyneth reached out and touched my hand. "It's not your fault, Leah," she said, as if she could read my thoughts. I pulled my hand away and jumped up from the chair. "Of course it's my fault! Who else's would it be? Those packs of hyenas are ranging right into Morrigan now because they're no longer afraid. All because I refused to marry someone I didn't love." I spit the last word out with every bit of the revulsion I was feeling. "No one knows with certainty if an alliance would have done anything to stop them," Bertie tried to reason. I looked at her, shaking my head, thinking that certainty didn't matter in the least anymore. Guarantees weren't even part of my universe right now. I would have married the devil himself if there had been even the slimmest chance it could have saved Greta and the baby. Who would be next? "It's only one rogue band, Leah, not an army. We've always had those, and the attack was on a remote border," Pauline argued. I walked over to the fireplace and stared at the small flame. She was right on that count. But this time it was something more. I could feel it. It was something gray and grim slithering through me. I remembered the hesitation in Walther's voice. "We'll keep them out. We always do." But not this time. It had been brewing all along. I just hadn't seen it. A crucial alliance, my mother had called it, was sacrificing a daughter the only way to achieve it. Maybe it was when so much distrust had been banked for centuries. This alliance was meant to be more than a piece of paper that could be burned. It was to be an alliance made of flesh and blood. I looked down at the tiny white lace cap in my hands that I had planned to give to Walther and Greta. I fingered the lace, remembering the joy I had in buying it. Greta was dead. The baby was dead. Walther was a crazed man. I tossed it into the fire, heard the hushed murmurs around me, watched the lace catch, curl, blacken, flame, become ash, as if it had never been there. "I need to go wash up." My legs were still caked in mud. "Do you want me to go with you?" Pauline asked. "No," I answered, and quietly closed the door behind me.
On the far side of death, past the great divide, where hunger eats souls, their tears will increase. Song of Venda. Chapter 40.
Thunk. 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 I had been standing in the meadow for 2 hours, throwing my knife over and over again. It was a small stump, and I rarely missed anymore. I had trampled the wild mustard down into a straight, neat path from going to retrieve the knife. There were only a few stray throws when I had allowed my mind to wander. Thunk. Thunk. And then the whir, the chink, the swish of it missing its mark and disappearing into the tall grass behind the stump. Walther's words, Walther's face, Walther's anguish wouldn't leave me. I tried to sort it all into something that made sense, but there was no sense, not when it came to murder. Greta wasn't a soldier. The baby hadn't even drawn a first breath. Savages. I went to find my knife, lost somewhere in the grass. Leah? I turned. It was Caden. He swung down from his horse. I knew by his manner he had heard something, probably from hushed voices in the tavern. How did you find me? It wasn't hard. The meadow bordered the road leading out of town. I supposed I was in full view of anyone passing by. Bertie said you and Rafe went out early this morning, before sunup. I listened to the flatness of my voice. It sounded like it belonged to someone else. I don't know where Rafe went. I had some arrangements to take care of. The duties you spoke of. He nodded. I looked at him, his hair blowing in the breeze, a white, burnished gold in the bright midday sun. His eyes rested on me, sure and steady. I kissed his cheek. You're a good person, Caden. Steadfast and true to your duty. Leah, can I go away, Caden? I said. Go away. I need time to think about my own duties. I turned and walked back through the meadow, not waiting to see if he listened to me or not. But I heard his horse trot off. I retrieved my knife from the grass and threw it again. Her dress was blue. The baby was moving.
I have to do something, Leah. I have to do something.
This time I saw more than Walther's face, more than Greta's. I saw Bryn. I saw Regan. I saw Pauline. I have to do something.
Chapter 41. Rafe.
It was twilight when I returned. I hadn't eaten all day, and my head was pounding. I led my horse to the barn and unsaddled him, feeling the burn of wind and sun on my skin from a long day of riding. I was tired, still trying to sort the timing of everything out. How would we pull this off? I raked my fingers through my hair. I hadn't planned my trip well, but after the late night with Leah, I'd had little sleep. We need to talk. I looked over my shoulder. I was so preoccupied, I hadn't heard her come in. I heaved my saddle onto the rack and faced her. Leah, where did you go? Her shoulders were stiff and her tone curt. I took a hesitant step toward her. I had some business to take care of. Is that a problem? An out-of-work farmhand with business? What was wrong with her? I told you my lack of work was temporary. Supplies needed to be ordered. I threw the horse blanket, still in my hands, over the stall wall and closed the space between us. I looked into her eyes, wanting to kiss every black lash, wondering how this had happened to me. She reached up and pulled my face down to hers, pressed her lips hard against mine, then slid her hands down my neck to my chest, and her fingers dug into my skin. It wasn't desire I heard in her breaths, but desperation. I pulled back. I stared at her and touched my lip where her rough kiss had nicked my flesh. "Something's wrong," I said. "I'm leaving, Rafe. Tomorrow." I stared at her, not quite understanding what she was saying. "What do you mean, leaving?" She walked over to a bale of hay in an empty stall and sat, looking up at the rafters. "I have to return home," she said. "I have an obligation I need to meet." "Home? Now?" My mind raced. "What kind of obligation?"
"The permanent kind. I won't be back."
"Ever?" She stared at me, her expression blank.
"Ever," she finally said. "I haven't told you everything about my family, Rafe. I've been manipulated and lied to my entire life. I'm not going back because I want to, but one fact remains. I've caused them and others a lot of pain through my disloyalties. If I don't go back, I may cause far more. I need to return to live up to my duty."
Her voice was rigid and unfeeling. I rubbed my chin. She looked so different, a different Leah than I had ever seen. Manipulated and lied to. I glanced away, my eyes darting back and forth, unable to focus. I tried to sort through what she had said and refigure my own thwarted plans at the same time. I looked back at her.
"And your family will give you this chance?"
"I don't know, but I have to try."
Tomorrow. I thought I had more time. It was too soon. The plans. Rafe. "Wait," I said. "Let me think. I have to figure this out."
"There's nothing to figure out."
"Does it have to be tomorrow? Can't it wait a few more days?"
"No. It can't wait."
She sat stone still. What had happened while I was gone? But it was obvious her decision was made and final. "I understand about duty, Leah," I said, trying to buy time and think this through. "Duty is important." "And loyalty," I swallowed, my throat dry with road dust.
"When will you leave tomorrow?" I asked.
"In the morning. Early." I nodded, even as my mind reeled. That gave me very little time, but one thing I knew with certainty. I couldn't let her go back to Civica.
Chapter 42.
There wasn't much to pack. Everything I had would fit into a double-sided saddlebag with room to spare. I wasn't taking the new clothes I'd bought. I'd leave those here for Pauline, since I couldn't wear them in Civica anyway. I'd take some food, too, but this time I'd be staying at inns along the way. That was one of the concessions I'd made when Pauline angrily threw the pouch of jewels I had given her back in my face. We had argued all afternoon. There had been words with Bertie, too, but she finally accepted that I had to go. As for Gwyneth, I think she knew all along, even before I did. But Pauline had become fierce in a way I had never seen. She finally stomped off to the tavern when I pulled my bag from the wardrobe. I couldn't tell her that hers had been one of the faces I had seen in the meadow. A face like Greta's, open-eyed but not seeing. Another casualty if I didn't do something. Whether the alliance ended up being effective or not, I couldn't take the chance of even one more person I loved being destroyed if I might have been able to prevent it. I looked around the small cottage to see if I had forgotten anything, and saw my garland of lavender flowers hanging from the bedpost. I couldn't take it with me, The dried flowers would only be crushed in the saddlebag. I lifted it from the bedpost and held it to my face, sniffing the fading scent. Wraith. I closed my eyes, trying to force